Welcome back to the second hour of Leading Edge Medicine. Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umeb. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine, while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. And now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umeb, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
Oh, boy. And Lynette has a little bit of the laryngitis going on, so our producer, Mark Holland, is in with me, helping to host.
I'm helping a little bit, and I get to mention the phone number, 800-465-8770. If you have a question for Dr. Mixon about any aging issue, medical question, we even talked about coffee today earlier in the hour. Call right now with your questions, 800-465-8770. That's 800-465-8770. It's Leading Edge Medicine, and we have still Bill on the line, and he was discussing with Dr. Mixon the best way to lose weight.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about weight management through a lifetime. There are several different stages we go through in our life. The first one is in our youth. There is something in built into us human beings called appetite sensing that tells us when we're hungry versus when we've had enough to eat. And most young children before adolescence are quite sensitive to that. The problem is their mothers. Because because what'll happen is the kid will sit down and they'll start to eat, and they eat about half of what's on their plate, and they try to quit. Because their appetite sensing is very sensitive, and it has now said, you've eaten enough, quit. And the kid wants to quit. And mom says, think of the starving children in China. Right. Clean your plate. You've got to eat the rest of that, or I'm going to spank you and put you in your room. Boy, they don't spank you anymore because that, you know, child protective services would come out and lock you up. But I'm going to do something horrible to you, like make you stand in a corner for 5 minutes. And so the kid is taught to clean their plate, whether they want it or not, which is, that's our fault as parents. And then, of course, we get to another stage, adolescence, in which we're growing rapidly. And we need vast amounts of calories because we're growing new tissue. We're getting taller and broader, and we're, you know, we're becoming men and women. And it's like we got a hollow leg. We can just eat and eat and eat and eat and eat. Whether we gain weight in that stage is more a function of how physically active we are and how we have internalized our clean plate club that we were taught as a child. If you haven't internalized it too much and you're physically active, you tend not to get fat as a teenager. Yeah, but you know, if you've internalized it too much and you eat everything they're given, you can develop a problem. Or if you're sedentary, if you spend your time in front of the computer or the TV instead of out riding your bike and playing ball and running and jumping. And then we get to our adult years, in which our growth spurt has stopped. And what we need to do now is to cut back our calorie intake because we're not growing anymore. And once more, if we have been habituated to what we are eating in our growth adolescent years, it'll make us fat as a grown-up because we don't need that much anymore. And the interesting thing is, as we age and our metabolism slows down, we need less and less and less. And so we actually have to start decreasing our plate size and our serving size as we get older because our metabolism is slowing down. We aren't making as much muscle and bone densities as we did when we were young men and women. Now, to some extent, at longevity, we can help that because we give you back the hormones. Like, as you have talked about, you're stronger than you were. You have more endurance than you were.
Yes.
So more of your body is now muscle, and muscle is very heavy. And that's why I ask about the InBody. Because sometimes people say, but I'm not losing weight, but I am getting stronger. And when we do those people's InBody, we find that their muscle ratio to fat is going up. They're getting more and more muscle, less and less fat. Their weight isn't changing, but more of them is muscle and less of them is fat. Okay. And you're almost to that target range. You're about 3% higher than we really need you to be. So you're pretty close. Okay. So
when I was in high school, I was a 32 waist. I'm a 33 now.
Yeah. Again, you're pretty close. You're about 3% off.
Wow, Bill, that's pretty impressive. Yeah. For 52 years.
For at 80.
One inch. Yeah.
Yes. So, you're doing a really good job. And the fact that you're getting stronger and having better endurance says the clinic is doing what we want it to do for you. What we have to do now is to address that last 3%. Because now we're polishing the gym. We're not mining anymore. Okay. And so a couple of questions. Have you had a couple of series of the anti-senescent cell therapy?
No.
Okay. That's one thing we might consider, because as we age and our immune system clears senescent cells slower and slower, and with our aging, we tend to make them a bit faster. Those senescent cells, it's a anti-senescent cell therapy. Okay, it's to kill the senescent cells, the zombie cells in your body. and let me explain that a little bit. Every cell in your body is designed to do its job for a specified period of time. And then it's supposed to die, get replaced by a new cell. We call that autophagocytic process, okay? Autophagy is a single word for it. And autophagy is very efficient when you're young. But as we get older, we start developing cells that reach the end of their lifespan but don't want to die. For instance, and let me give some examples. Your skin tends to live 2 to 4 weeks, depending on where the skin is on your body. And you're replacing skin cells all the time. Your gut, the lining of your gut, 30 to 40 hours. Okay. So every couple of days, you get a whole new lining to your gut. Your muscles tend to last 3 to 4 months, and then you replace new muscle cells. Your bones, we replace about 10% of our skeleton every year. So every 10 years, you got a whole new skeleton. Your neurons, the brain cells, they turn over years at a time. They die and are replaced very slowly, but they do get replaced over time. So what happens is some of your cells all over in your brain, your skin, your bones, your liver, your heart, your lungs, some small percentage of cells reach the end of their life. And instead of dying and being replaced with a fresh new cell, they become senile, a senescent cell. And those senile cells actually change their shape, they change their function and their morphology, and they now start kicking out anti-growth, anti-healing and repair chemicals into the environment. And so that's part of why as we age and we build up our senescent cell load, we are less and less able to heal and repair and replace damaged tissue because we're getting a bigger and bigger load of senescent cells. We now know that we can get rid of a large percentage of those senescent cells. So there's some medications, dasatinib combined with quercetin, 3 days of therapy each week for 3 weeks will get rid of about 70% of the senescent cells in your body and allow your metabolism to shift back over to healing and repair more efficiently. Now, we need to do that periodically as time goes on, because being old, we tend to start regrowing senescent cells over time. So, I get the full 9 days over 3 weeks therapy once or twice a year, and then I do some smaller 3-day courses periodically through the year. So to keep my senescent cell load down, that means I preferentially make lean, hard tissues instead of inflamed fat. Okay. So one of the things we might consider with you is to have your doctor put you on the senescent cell therapy and see if that helps you get rid of that last bit of fat you want to get. The other way is you might take a look at your eating pattern, okay, and try to not eat at night after about 5 or 6 o'clock. And the reason there is when you eat in the evening, it takes 4 or 5 hours to digest that food, 6 hours if it's a big meal. If you're still snacking at 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night and you go to bed, your metabolism, when you fall asleep, is going to drop to its lowest rate in the entire 24-hour period. Your metabolism is not going to burn many calories. And yet you've got food in your gut being digested, bringing energy into the system. Now, you're not an oil well. We can't just flare that gas off and burn it. We got to do something with those calories, with that energy that's coming in from your gut. And if you can't burn it because you're sleeping, what do you think you do with it? You make fat and store it for the next day. So every night of your life, you're going to do one of two things. You're either going to make new fat or you're going to burn old fat. If you haven't eaten for 5 hours or so, 6 hours before you go to bed, and now your metabolism slows way down, you're not going to die before the sun comes up, I promise. What you're going to do is you're going to get the energy to stay alive by burning fat. And every night you're either burning fat or making fat. And going to bed with a full tummy makes fat. Going to bed with an empty tummy burns fat. That's pretty simple observation. So a lot of people do their intermittent fasting, their 12 to 15 hours of not eating overnight. Finish your last meal by 6 o'clock. Don't eat again till 7 or 8 the next morning. Hey, you got it made.
Okay.
Okay. So.
Yeah. Well, I swim at 6 in the morning. So.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm usually up at 5 or so myself. And but at 6, I've had my breakfast and I'm heading out on the trail for 3 miles, you know. But I don't eat. I don't eat after about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I have a big, nice big breakfast. I go out, I get my exercise, I go to work, I eat a late lunch, and then I don't do dinner. So that's where I do my intermittent fast.
So you would say that I'm going in for my evaluation in a week. So ask him about senescent cell therapy.
Ask him about senescent cell therapy. You know, we usually save the senescent cell. What we normally do when a new patient comes in, first we look at the things we can change in lifestyle and diet, and then we'll go ahead and we get all their hormone balancing and stuff cleaned up. And then after about 6 months or so on the hormones where we see where we got them, then we'll usually consider the senescent cell therapy. So talk to your doc about the senescent cells, let him evaluate and decide when and where he wants to do that. Okay.
I've been there 9 months about.
Okay. So certainly, you know, you should be stable enough. They should be willing to consider senescent cell therapy on you.
Okay. Thanks, doctor.
You're welcome, sir. Take care.
Okay. And that opens up a line for you. If you're listening today to Leading Edge Medicine, your questions for Dr. Mixon, I don't think anything's off limits for you. It sounds like you can talk
very
about
little.
Just about anything.
Oh, boy. Yes, he can.
800-465-8770. 800-465-8770 is the number to call right now with your questions. It's Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon. Dr. Umat has the week off, I guess, next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
This Saturday and next.
Okay. So. I'm Mark in for, well, helping Lynette. I'm training with Lynette today.
That's right. And Mark will be filling in for me when I take some vacation this summer.
Okay. 800-465-8770 is the number to call with your questions on Leading Edge Medicine.
All right. We'll be right back. Stay right there.
Come on like a dream, peaches and cream, lips like strawberry wine. You're 16, you're beautiful, and you're mine.
And welcome back to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon. Mark Holland helping out Lynette Morgan today, and it's a Mother's Day weekend. And I think moms might be already taking a break and taking some time off. Sunshine. And
yep, the dads hopefully have got taken all out for a healthy picnic.
And, there we go. Yep, we're going to the beach tonight with all the kids and grandkids.
On the grass, on a blanket, under a tree with a shade.
There you go.
Love it.
Don't you love napping on the grass
on
a warm day?
With an airplane going over?
I don't care about the airplane.
I just love hearing the sound of when my eyes are shut. It's like,
I see.
Oh.
Okay.
Quiet.
800-465-8770 is the number to call with your questions. 800-465-8770. Dr. Mixon, I have a question. I alluded to this a little earlier, I think. Recently diagnosed with a heart arrhythmia. Mm-hmm. I've heard from the doctor that actually this is a pretty common problem, different forms of arrhythmia.
Yep.
And it can be caused by all kinds of things. I've been having kind of these intermittent little episodes at times where I'd get felt like almost like a rush of caffeine or something.
Oh, wow.
And I never know. Sometimes it would come on from walking vigorously, or I was sitting there doing my taxes.
That'll do it.
At
that'll
the computer. Do it every time. At the computer. That was when I had my last little event. So what is an arrhythmia, and what are some of the treatments for that?
Well, okay, let's look at the arrhythmia, and then we'll look at the underlying cause, because the treatment's based on the causes. Mm. You know, if you don't know what's causing your problem, the chances of fixing it are pretty low. Mm. So, arrhythmia just means that the heart rhythm is different from what it should be. That simple. Normal rhythm is we call sinus rhythm. There is a sinus node up in the upper atrium, the right upper portion of the atrium. Let me back up, I guess, structurally. The heart is divided into four chambers. You got two atria, right and left atria, and these are kind of the preload chambers. Blood comes back from the veins, gets dumped into the right atria. The right atria is supposed to contract and just push the blood down into the right ventricle. The ventricles, the two big ventricles, are the main pumping chambers. That right ventricle pumps the blood out into your lungs, where the carbon dioxide is expressed out, so you can exhale your carbon dioxide, and you pick up oxygen from the lungs, and then that goes into the left atrium. The left atrium now contracts and pumps the blood down into the left ventricle. This is the big main pumping chamber of the heart. That left ventricle pumps, and that pushes the blood out under high pressure to every artery in your body. And so it perfuses your brain and your muscles and your gut and so on. And then that blood goes out through smaller and smaller and smaller blood vessels till the tiniest vessels we call capillaries. And the capillaries are so small that red blood cells have to go through one cell at a time in single file. And the walls are very thin and fragile. And this is where the oxygen diffuses out of your red blood cells into the tissues. And the carbon dioxide diffuses out of the tissues into the red cells and gets carried back in the veins. And those capillaries empty into small veins, into bigger and bigger and bigger veins, and then finally back to the right atrium. Okay. So that's the circulation in a nutshell. All right. That right atrium has a node, a little wad of tissue called the sinus node. And the sinus node is supposed to control the heart rate. And so it beats rhythmically. It has an autorhythmicity. And it contracts. It sends a signal out and tells the right atrium to contract. And then it tells the right ventricle to contract. And then it tells the impulse sweeps across the heart, causes the left atria to contract, and then the left ventricle. So it's a sequence. Mm. Okay. Right atrium, right ventricle, left atrium, left ventricle. And it has to fire in sequence. Here's your problem. As we age, our blood vessels are going bad. Mm. Those little tiny, tiny vessels that are so small that the blood vessels are going through it in single file, and it's carrying the oxygen in one way and the carbon dioxide, those are the first vessels that go bad with aging. Mm. the tiniest ones. Now, we can't see those individual vessels. When we do an angiogram on your heart, we're looking at the great big vessels, those the ones that will plug up and kill you. Those tiny vessels start going bad very early. And when enough of them go bad, what they do is they basically poison the nerves, those fine nerves that are causing the autorhythmicity. So those nodes that are supposed to fire and cause the heart to start contracting in sequence, they're getting sick. Mm. And as they get sick, sometimes they fire too fast, sometimes they fire too slow, sometimes they'll just quit working. And so we develop a series of different heart rhythms as we get older.
I said tachycardia, something
like that. Tachycardia just means your heart is beating faster than 100 beats a minute.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And I checked, my blood pressure was fine, but my pulse was like up to 140.
Yeah. You know, and so you're getting...
For half an hour.
Yeah. And if it is still coming from the sinus node, we call that a sinus tachycardia. And that's not dangerous, but it's a nuisance.
Yeah.
And we'd like to slow it down.
Well, it's worrying because you feel like maybe am I having a heart attack? Yeah. And I'll be short of breath for a while. You know, so.
Yeah. And so that one is not dangerous, but it's a nuisance. Mm. And so we often treat it with a low-dose beta blocker, which simply slows down the heart rate a bit.
Which is what I was put on.
Yeah. Now, more concerning would be if the ventricle was going bad and you were getting a ventricular tachycardia, because those will often have you, the big pumping chambers trying to pump 200-300 times a minute, and there's no time for them to fill with blood, and your blood pressure drops out to zip, and you die if that continues.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have everything from the minor, the sinus tachycardia that is just a nuisance and is fairly easy to treat, to the fatal ventricular tachycardias that can kill you off. And there's a whole lot of rhythms in between. And atrial fibrillation is probably the single most common one that we see.
Okay, well, that's very good information.
See,
now
that is
now
good.
You had your cardiac anatomy class.
So I'm coming in helping Lynette today, and I get my own little diagnosis and
wonderful
help from Dr. Mixon. People would love to get their questions answered. We've got a couple people on the line, but room for you to get in, too, if you're listening. 800-465-8770. John called that in Tacoma. And, John, you have a question for Dr. Mixon.
Hello, John.
Hi. Question I have for you, if you're on a testosterone supplement, which would be cream, and you've been taking it for, say, 4 or 5 months on a program, and you notice that, you know, I'm not really seeing a lot of changes in libido, I'm still working out at the gym, I'm doing everything, I'm doing that, but you notice that your testicles are getting significantly smaller. When would you stop taking testosterone?
Good question. Okay, first of all, I've been using testosterone creams since I was 49 years old, and I'm now 75, turning 76. So I've been on it a long time. When you raise your testosterone levels high enough, there's a feedback loop, and your own testicles say, "Hey, I got plenty of testosterone. I don't need to make any." And so if you're not making your own, then the testicles kind of get smaller and smaller. They become atrophic is what we call that. That's one of the reasons that in our clinic, we have our patients generally put the testosterone on in the morning and wash it off in the early evening. Because the half-life of testosterone is about 75 minutes. So when you wash it off with soap and water, hour and 15 minutes later, half of it's out of your system. Hour and 15 minutes after that, another half is out of your system. So in 2.5 hours, you've lost 3/4 of the testosterone. And now your own testicles can start to work. So I like to have people wash it off every night, every evening. And that way your own testicles get to work for 12, 15 hours a day. And so you don't normally get the atrophy that way. Okay. Some guys don't wash it off fast enough. Some guys leave it on 24/7, which I think is a real mistake. Some guys do the pellets or the shots. We can guarantee they're going to get testicular atrophy. It happens. From a medical standpoint, it's not important because unless you're trying to father children, because you know it's a pretty good birth control. On the other hand, emotionally, most men were born with a pair and they want to die with a pair. And there is, you know, there is a emotional component to finding out that your testicles are shrinking up, you know, from walnuts to almonds. And so there is a way to fix that. And what we'll do is we'll cut your dose of testosterone a bit. We make sure you wash it off. And then about three times a week for about 3 months, we'll give you a little shot, a little subcutaneous injection of chorionic gonadotropin.
Say that three times.
HCG.
Oh, okay.
HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin. And this is a hormone that triggers your testicles to go back to work and make testosterone. And so we force them to go back to work and produce testosterone whether they want to or not. And that means they start growing again. And over the course of 3 or 4 months, we can grow them back to full size. Okay. So it's one of the things we warn our guys about if it happens, and if you're washing it off the way we tell you to, it probably won't. But if it happens, we can grow them back. And I'll tell you a little bit of a slightly ribald story. So all of you that are pearl-clutching progressives who have never heard, you know, about a man's anatomy, please turn down the radio for the next 3 minutes, and then you can turn it back up.
There I go. Should I go get new coffee now?
Go get yourself a coffee, because I know that you are a sweet and innocent young thing.
I'm gonna stay.
Okay, Mark will stay.
All right. I had a patient many years ago who liked his testosterone and saw no reason to wash it off. And he ignored my advice for a long period of time. I have no idea how long it had been since he'd washed it off. But he was single. He had a new girlfriend. He took her to Hawaii, and they decided to make love on the beach. And in the process of their play, she suddenly looked up at him and said, "My God, Frank, you don't have any balls." Now, as you might expect, he was upset. So he called me in a panic and from Hawaii. And I said, "Okay, I know exactly what's going on here. You were not washing it off, were you?" And he said, "No, I wasn't. I didn't think it was." So we brought him home. We grew them back for him. It took about 6 months. We just could put him on his chorionic gonadotropin, and he did fine. So this is a fixable problem if it's happening. And, you know, God, what has it been now? 25, 26, 27 years I've been on testosterone. About three times in 27 years, I have noticed that mine are starting to get smaller than I want them to be. And I will go on chorionic gonadotropin for a couple of months and kick it back into high gear. It's a fixable issue. Don't worry about it. Just talk to your longevity doctor.
Okay, and if you see a urologist, your urologist says that, you know, they've done a biopsy on everything, your prostate, whatever you call the dart stuff, the PSA.
PSA?
Low.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said that's low, but he says, but you have BPE, benign prostate enlargement. Does testosterone create that?
Actually, in a roundabout way, we got to take a break, but sit tight and I'll talk to you about prostatic enlargement and testosterone and estrogen and progesterone.
Okay, John, hang in there. We'll come back to you after this break. The number to call with your question for Dr. Mixon, 800-465-8770, 800-465-8770. This is Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon. Welcome back to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon. There's room for you to call in your question right now at 800-465-8770. Mark Holland joining Lynette Morgan today because she's having some
allergy, throat.
And yes. I'm also kind of training because I might sit in and fill in for her one of these Saturdays.
Yeah, I'm going to go on vacation here pretty soon.
One of these Saturdays. Happy Mother's Day to everybody listening today as well. And continuing talking with John in Tacoma.
All right. John, another little physiology anatomy lesson. Then just we did that for the heart. Now we're going to do it for the prostate. Okay.
I'll do that.
All right. Human beings, male and female, all make the same mix of hormones. We all make testosterone, progesterone, pregnenolone, dehydroepiandrosterone, testosterone, cortisols, growth hormone, insulin. All of the hormones are identical, except in amounts and ratios. Okay. Men have more testosterone than women do. Women have more estrogen than men do, but men make estrogen, women make testosterone. In fact, a healthy young woman makes 2.5 to 3 times more testosterone than she does estrogen. Testosterone is the primary sex hormone for men and women. We have receptors for all of those hormones in tissues scattered all over our bodies. And those receptors are there for a reason. They're not just decoration. Okay. Progesterone alters the function of the estrogen alpha receptor. There are two kinds of receptors for estradiol, the primary human estrogen, alpha and beta. Women have more alpha receptors than men. Men have more beta receptors than women. Those receptors, those different types of receptors, change the way our body fat and our musculature is laid down. That beta receptors, beta estrogen receptors in men are why we get big bellies when we gain weight, when we get fat. Okay. The alpha receptors in women are what lays down the fat under their skin to make women soft and smooth and curvaceous. Okay, so they put their fat first on their butts, their thighs, and then their breasts, and their bellies last. We put our fat first on our bellies, and then later on our butts and thighs. So you'll see guys with a great big belly and little tiny butt, you know, and that's just because that's the difference in the types of estrogen receptors that we men have compared to women. Okay, we have estrogen receptors in our prostates, just as women have estrogen receptors in their breasts. And we also have progesterone receptors in our prostate. The progesterone in a man's prostate alters the function of the alpha estrogen receptor. I know that's a little bit weird and deep in the woods, but try and stay with me, okay? The alpha estrogen receptors in your prostate are altered by the progesterone in your system. Progesterone alters that receptor at 127 different sites on its genome, which is totally useless information, but it sticks in my brain. What it does is it prevents your prostate from enlarging. As you age and your progesterone levels are dropping, your body fat is converting testosterone into estrogen. The estrogen receptor is responding to that estrogen, but because it doesn't have enough progesterone, you start enlarging the prostate. It starts immortalizing the epithelial cells in your prostate. So as progesterone is dropping, the prostate starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, the reason that I said, yes, testosterone does so indirectly, okay? Estradiol and testosterone are identical molecules except for one hydroxyl group. One little hydroxyl group is the difference in estrogen and testosterone. There is an enzyme in male fat that strips off that hydroxyl group and turns testosterone into estrogen. And so as men age, their testosterone is dropping and their estrogen is rising. And when we give men extra testosterone, if they have much in the way of body fat, they're going to convert a fair bit of that testosterone into estrogen. And that estrogen impact on the alpha estrogen receptor in your prostate, in the absence of enough progesterone, causes your prostate to get big.
Okay. Right. That's why that happens.
That's why that happens.
Okay.
And that's why I give men progesterone. Okay. When I give them testosterone, I also usually give them progesterone. And the progesterone helps keep the prostate from enlarging because it puts back the progesterone you had as a young man. So it's not just testosterone a man needs. Okay, we alter 8 different hormones in every man and woman in our clinic. The reason we measure 8 hormones is we use all 8 hormones to optimize your body's function. Okay, a man should never be given just testosterone. A woman should never be given just estradiol. Okay, we should look at all 8 hormones and adjust all 8 in every man and every woman getting hormone therapy. And if you're just getting testosterone, you're being mistreated.
Okay.
It's that simple.
And the last thing I got for you, if you don't mind, is so you go to a normal physical every year and you tell your urologist guy or your, you know, normal practice guy, yeah, I'm taking testosterone therapy. So and they go, oh, don't do that. That's going to mess you up. It's bad on your heart. It's bad on this. It's bad
no,
on
No, it's
that.
Not. It lowers your risk of heart attacks. It lowers your risk of strokes. It actually prolongs lifespan in men. Have your doctor send me a note, and I'll send him a series of peer-reviewed medical journal articles on the benefits of testosterone in older men and women.
Okay. All right.
What you really need to do is if you're going to mess with your hormones, you need to come to Longevity where we have doctors
already
that do
there.
This for a living. Yeah, because your regular doc is not going to do it properly.
I'm already here at the Tacoma office.
Wonderful. Okay. Sounds good to me. Thank you for the call, sir. Hopefully we've educated a few folks.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Okay, hey, moving to Robert in Seattle. And Robert, what is your question, Robert?
Yes,
what, sir?
I have a question. Yes, I have a question about the hormone cascade you give, the 8 or 9 hormones for testosterone related. Are they all shots or all like, are they some of them creams?
And some are creams, some are pills. Go ahead.
Okay. You usually give all 8?
No. What we do is we measure what your levels are. And some people need a lot of one thing and a little bit of another. But you have to, if you don't measure, you don't know. And so we measure all of them and we look and see where you are. And we look at the ratios and the balances and we start giving you what it is you need. And that will change over time.
Okay.
You know, so.
Your doctors also prescribe, can they prescribe armored thyroid? And what about Adderall?
Sure they can. Well, they do
can.
Armored thyroid. They could do Adderall, but we don't. Okay, that's a psychiatric drug. We are aging doctors, not psychiatrists, so we stay away from the, you know, the psychotropics.
Mm-hmm. Can you still do a discount for cash for the year?
I'm sorry, what?
Oh, a discount for using cash for the year?
Yes. Yeah, I think, yes. And I'm not sure what it is, but I think it's a 5% discount for people who pay up front.
Okay, thanks a lot for the questions.
You're welcome, sir. Take care.
Okay, thank you, Robert. And moving on to an off-air question. She just wanted to ask a question. Pam in Centralia, if on blood thinner like Eliquis, when would you suggest the Watchman procedure?
Watchman procedure.
Right.
Yeah. Education time.
My goodness. All right. If you're on Eliquis and you're thinking about a Watchman, it's probably because you have atrial fibrillation.
There you go.
Okay. Atrial fibrillation is dangerous for a couple of reasons. It can cause an uncontrolled tachycardia in which the heart is just beating too fast. Or it can do the opposite. It can cause an uncontrolled bradycardia, in which the ventricle rate slows down too much. So we use a set of drugs to alter the speed of the heart. One of the problems with atrial fibrillation, though, is those upper chambers, those atria we described, are not contracting. They're just kind of sitting there wiggling a bit. They're fibrillating. That's why we call it atrial fibrillation. The atria are just wiggling. And that means the blood flow along the surface, especially in the left atrial appendage, gets stagnant. The blood doesn't want to move much. And so it can form a clot. And that clot, if you then switch from fibrillation to sinus and your heart beats normally for a time or two, it can actually break that clot off and send it out and cause you to have a pulmonary embolism or a stroke and die. So we don't want that. And that's why she's on the Eliquist.
Okay.
So people in atrial fibrillation, we put them on Eliquist to decrease their ability to clot so that they don't get that problem if they switch back and forth between atrial fibrillation and sinus rhythm. The next question is one that I would defer to the cardiologist, and that's when would you put in a Watchman? The Watchman is basically a little plug that they put into the heart through a catheter. They maneuver it into the left atrial appendage, and they anchor it there. And it fills up that left atrial appendage so that the blood can't get in there to get stagnant and form a clot.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So it's basically a spacer that we put where the most common place to form clots are. So if your doctor is concerned that your anticoagulation may not be giving you enough control, then he may consider putting a Watchman in you.
All right.
Okay.
Hopefully that was helpful for Pam.
The Watchman procedure for Pam. And if you have a question for Dr. Mixon, it's a great time to call right now as we go to a break. 800-465-8770. 800-465-8770. It's Longevity Medical Clinic. Leading Edge Medicine is the program. Dr. Jerry Mixon, the doctor.
Absolutely.
And we'll be back with your questions in a moment.
Many a tear has to fall, but it's all in the game. All in the wonderful game that we know.
Okay, back with more of Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon, Mark Holland, helping out Lynette Morgan today as Lynette is having some struggles with allergies.
Allergies, yes.
Her voice, we actually have a question about allergies here in a minute.
Oh, good.
But maybe room for you to call as well, 800-465-8770. Carlos in Tacoma, you have a question about allergies for Dr. Mixon.
Hello, Carlos.
Hi, Carlos.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Dr. Mixon, and your staff for the good information you always give up on the weekends. I got this problem, and thank you for your service also. I did 30 years in the service also, and I'm retired, and I feel like you, 68. I feel like I keep going. Sun come out, I'm ready to go and everything, but lately the sun has come out, and I'm terrible with these damn allergies. And I said, let me ask Dr. Mixon because he always knows pretty much everything we can use. I'm planning to come to that clinic, and first thing I want to do because I'm getting in that age, I'm going to do the testosterone thing. Yeah, that's going to be my next move because I'm a single guy and I'm out and about. The sun comes out, and I want to get up and about, but the allergies are killing me.
Okay.
So what should I do?
Well, you got a couple of choices. The cheapest, fastest, easiest one, of course, is to use an antihistamine that will block that mast cell degranulation. The trick is which antihistamine to use. And there are several out there that are very good at keeping you awake and alert. You know, you don't want to use the sedating ones.
No.
things like diphenhydramine.
Yeah, I want to say, Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Things like Benadryl, they make you really drowsy. And the bad news is that they also have an anticholinergic effect and they decrease thinking and brain function and actually can accelerate the development of dementia. So I try to stay away from the sedating antihistamines. But depending on what your symptoms are, you may want to, instead of being a systemic treatment, you may just want to get local treatment. For instance, if it's just a runny nose, there may be some anti-allergy nasal sprays you can use. You can chat with your doc and maybe get one that you can just spray up your nose and only block that part of your immune system and not have to take something systemic. Okay. If, yeah. on the other hand, you've got multiple symptoms, you get puffy eyes, runny nose, stuffy ears, you know, rashes, cough,
sore
wheezing,
throat.
Sore throat.
Lose your voice.
Yeah, now we got to use something systemic.
Yeah. That's what I got. I pretty much have everything, and I've been dealing with this since I came to the state of Washington. I love the state of Washington. I love the weather and everything. But these allergies, and they, I have tried that tenescent. Pretty much all this allergy counter, you know, Allegra was the one that actually I had it for almost 10 years. But then Allegra, it kind of, when I was younger, 20 years ago, my prostate got bigger. And so the doctor said, you can't use Allegra no more. So Allegra was the one that did the trick. But I run out of options now because I try and put it much all of them.
Yeah. Well, then, folks, in your situation, we got a couple of choices that are a little fancier and more expensive and less convenient. For instance, you can go to an allergist, a doctor who specializes in allergy, and they can do some testing to see exactly which of our local pollens and allergens are giving you the grief. Okay. They can actually run a test. They know what ones usually cause problems in this area. And once they identify it, they can do what's called a desensitization series. They take a little bit of that allergen, they dilute it dramatically, and they inject it into your body. And then every few weeks, they give you a little bigger and a little bigger and a little bigger dose of it until your body learns to adjust and tolerate that allergen. And and so we call that a desensitization series. And they can actually fix it so you're no longer sensitive to that allergen. Okay. Now, another choice, if you're not totally in love with Washington State, is move to
move to an island. Yes. Yeah.
But if you move to the windward side of Hawaii, now you've got the air, the breeze is blowing across 4,000 miles of ocean before it gets you. There's no pollens or anything left in it.
Oh, yes.
And you've got totally fresh, clean, warm air to breathe.
Okay.
So that's another possibility.
Also, somebody told me, go to Arizona, dry heat. But
yeah, it's true.
I love Washington, though.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the problem with Arizona is you've got the fungi in the soil. And there's a lot of people then develop sensitivities to the funguses that are blowing around in the desert wind. So, so I like either non-sedating antihistamines, desensitization, or moving to the windward side of Hawaii.
There we go.
Any of those three.
My doctor
The Hawaii would be good, but I'm actually from Puerto Rico. In Puerto Rico, I never have any allergies, so... What I'm going to do is come summertime, I can go to Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and then come back over here in the winter. Because I love Washington.
Sounds good to me. Sure.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Dr. Nixon, for all your input. For your good work. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Hey, one more call.
One more call. We have Bob in Olympia. He has a question for Dr. Mixon. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Yeah, hi, doctor. Say, I had prostate cancer about 18 months ago. I had the beam radiation, and then they wanted to get me onto Lupron. I did one Lupron shot. I'm 77 years old, and I thought, I don't want to die of hot flashes and male boobs. But are you totally out of the ballpark as far as getting testosterone after having prostates?
It depends. Okay. Statistically, men who go on testosterone after successful treatment with prostate cancer have exactly the same reoccurrence rate as men who do not go on testosterone. So the testosterone doesn't seem to make a difference in whether or not the cancer will come back. Okay. About if you've had a successful therapy and your PSA is less than one, odds on a reoccurrence are about 5%. And they're 5% with or without testosterone. So I've got a lot of good papers on that. That has been studied over and over and over again. You know, we used to think back in the bad old days that testosterone caused prostate cancer. And it turns out that's not true. Men with high testosterone, men with low testosterone get the same rate.
What about adding testosterone back in, though? That seems because the that has to suppress the.
Well, again, it depends on what's going on. Okay, if you've got a high risk of metastasis, of spread of the cancer, okay, then that's why they'd be looking at Lupron for you. So, what was your Gleason score on your tumor?
It was 8.
Okay, so yeah. So at 8, you got a higher risk. So were you a stage what? 1, 2, 3?
I don't know.
Okay. Did you have any metastasis? Did they find tumors anywhere else?
None. Everything was contained within the prostate.
Okay. Except that it's an 8. See, if you've got a 6 or 7, you have a 93% chance that you can go forever, take all the testosterone you want, 93% chance it'll never cause you any grief, even if you didn't have any treatment. Okay. Even if you didn't get the radiation. Right. If you're an 8, that says that you have a high statistical chance of spread. They didn't find any spread, so that's the good news. But they're worried that there might be hiding some out there that they haven't found yet. There might be the tumor is so small. What's your PSA now after treatment?
It's less than 0.1.
Okay. So they're offering you the Lupron as protection in an effort to keep you from getting a reoccurrence. Yeah.
My question is more than the Lupron is because without testosterone, it really affects your sex drive and ability to have everything. Sex.
Yeah. The Lupron will make it worse. The Lupron will totally wipe out all of your steroid hormones and depression, fatigue, no libido, suicide rate goes up by 300% in men on Lupron. It really does.
You don't die of cancer, you just kill yourself.
Yes, yes.
Get you depressed.
Because a significant number of men literally would rather die than live on Lupron. I mean, that's a fact of life. So, you know, Lupron is a choice. Recognize, though, that if you've got a met that has simply not been found yet, and we add testosterone instead of the Lupron, then you've got a chance that it's going to start growing again. Okay. It won't cause a new tumor, but if you've got one that they just haven't found yet, the testosterone may well help feed it. And that's why they want to give you the Lupron to prevent that.
Would the PSA pick that up, though?
The PSA, yes. And if the PSA starts to rise, then you'd go off the testosterone and on the Lupron right away.
Yeah. Okay,
oh, I hear
thank
the music.
You very much.
You're welcome, sir.
Hey, thanks,
take
Bob.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Bob.
Hey, to find out more about Longevity Medical Clinic, go to lmclinic.com. And to maybe book your free health analysis appointment, call 1-866-86-YOUNG. Leading Edge Medicine Program with Dr. Jerry Mixon.
Oh, yes, and we'll be back next week, and hopefully I'll have a voice next week.
Happy Mother's Day, Mom.
Yes, thank you. Mark's been calling me Mom ever since I became a mom, and now I'm a grandmother of 3.
Oh, I love that.
Yes, happy Mother's Day. And
hey, Granny.
Nana Net. Have a great rest of your weekend. Enjoy that sunshine, and thank you for tuning in to Leading Edge Medicine.